at the edge of the universe when the future is in peril.
We've got Cardassians on our back doorstep.
One man faces an impossible mission.
I will do the job I've been ordered to do, sir.
To protect a defenseless space station.
I don't believe the Federation has any business being here.
Command an untested crew. And to relive a deadly encounter.
You will disarm your weapons.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And we have a very special guest this week, emerging from a wormhole, Mike Hager.
Woo! Hey, thanks for coming on the show, Mike. You've been begging us for years at this point, and we finally figured it's time to let you on.
Thank you. You must be pretty damn far down the guest list to get to me.
You're the part of the totem pole that's buried underneath the ground, you know? But that gives it a little bit of base.
Okay,
so
right on.
I appreciate that. What's the conundrum this week, Cam?
We are going to talk about Emissary, the Deep Space Nine premiere. But before we do that, Mike, I'm just curious, what is sort of your background with Star Trek? How has it affected your life?
I think it's been pretty ineffectual. I dabbled with TNG a bit.
Yeah.
Saw a couple reruns of the old Captain Kirk. What was the movie with the whales communicating with Spock?
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
The Voyage Home, yeah. Mm-hmm. I just remember a couple scenes from that. And I saw a couple clips of Deep Space Nine, didn't speak to me.
Sure.
Right.
This is very kind of casual relationship with Star
clicked
Trek.
Clicked on and off of Deep Space Nine. But I really got in... No, I was joking. I
was wondering where you're going.
The J.J. Abrams reboot, I saw the first one, didn't want to see the second one.
Okay. Really?
I liked the first one, though.
Yeah. Okay. But you didn't want to see the second one.
I read bad reviews, and I read...
It's interesting, because, like, the bad reviews came from the hardcore fans, not the critics, though. Mm. So, maybe he was just listening to us.
I saw the trailer, too, and it was just all CGI.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It seemed, I don't know. What do you guys think of the second one?
We weren't really big fans.
No. I'm not a big fan at all.
So, I think when we ranked it on our ranks of... films, mm-hmm. It did not rank so high on either of our lists.
Low middle, somewhere in there, yeah.
So. But you have all of Lost, I saw.
Yeah. Oh, I like J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
You know.
Where'd he go wrong?
With Star Trek Into Darkness, the script.
Yeah.
It was bad, so.
And he didn't write the script, to be fair. He approved it, though.
Oh, yeah. He was a director, though. I mean, it's his baby.
Yes, so. It's true. And he does run the production company.
But, I mean, look, we're talking about a feature film, and this, in a way, it's 90 minutes long, and I think what we want to do is see if Emissary justifies itself as a two-part episode based on this length, because I think it felt long during certain points. So, much like the wormhole aliens need to be explained time, I think maybe the editors could have a little bit as well.
It's funny, because they actually had to edit out 24 minutes of this episode.
Wow. So all we had left is gold.
David Carson, the director, said he hopes to have it reinstated one day.
It could be part of that documentary that Ira Stephen Bear has promised us.
Sure. So, Tyler, Mike, you've obviously never seen Emissary in the past. This was your first time. And we're going to get to your kind of sort of a non-Trek fan's point of view on this pilot. Does it have any appeal for a non-fan? But before we do that, Tyler, why don't you talk about your first time seeing this this pilot?
You know, it was actually a big deal. I was 8 years old, and it was... just huge that a new Star Trek series was premiering. I remember all my friends, we watched it. As a kid, I think you're just like dazzled by something new, and something like this was cool. I believe up until that point, it was the highest rated episode of Star Trek ever, at least in the modern era.
Yeah, it got an 18.8 rating.
That's
what does that mean?
18.8 million people or households watched it.
I think,
right?
Yeah.
So, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So
it was a big deal.
It was. And so as a kid, I dug it. I thought, hey, this is fascinating. But I was not a week-to-week viewer when it came to Deep Space Nine. Unlike Next Generation, I was a week-to-week viewer at that point. So I was very much a casual fan for the first few seasons of Deep Space Nine, because I think, Cam, as we progress through the two-parters, we're going to figure out that it takes a little while for DS9 to get going.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Cam, your first experience with this premiere episode.
It's funny. Just sorry, flashing back to 1993 when this premiered, I remember the hoopla surrounding it. I remember there was on my local...
A little older.
I was a little older, yeah. You know, on one of our local affiliate stations, they would show previews for this. And it was a big deal. And it was kind of an extended preview, maybe like 3 or 4 minutes. And I saw it quite a few times, and it looked like a big deal. Now, yeah. I was not someone who watched TNG. I had friends who did. I'd seen a lot of the original crew movies, but I hadn't watched much TNG. Maybe one or two episodes. But I remember seeing the trailer for this thing and thinking, like, well, this is huge. And believe me, they were showing every shot of exploding ships and, you know, anything like that to make it look big. And so I was really asking all my friends who watched Star Trek, saying, like, you know, are you going to watch Deep Space Nine? And they're like, oh, yeah, we're not missing it. I missed it. I didn't watch it.
Okay.
But, you know, I went to school the next day and I asked them all, like, how was it? Because, you know, they all taped it, so I wasn't too worried anyway.
Yeah.
And they were like, eh. And so I never watched it.
Okay.
You know, flash forward many, many years later, I guess, was it like 2011? 2012?
Yeah, it would have been 2011.
2011. So I'm in journalism school and I meet this strange duck named Tyler and I've just finished watching, and Mike, and I've just finished watching the original series and Tyler really says I should watch Deep Space Nine. So I went to a used DVD store and I bought season one and I went home and I watched this pilot and maybe it was because I was coming off the original series. I think if I'd been coming off TNG, I may have been a little more open to it. But coming off original series, which is so kind of colorful and action-packed and really...
Swashbuckling,
bigger personalities. I was kind of thrown by this pilot. Now, I quickly got into the series, but the pilot did not wow me my first time through.
Okay, well, Mike, I want to know your initial thoughts. Just coming off of it, we can go deeper in as we progress through the episode. But tell me, just after watching it just a few moments ago, what are your initial thoughts on this premiere episode?
I thought there was a lot of exposition. Like, it was a lot of setting the scene. You could tell it was a pilot.
Yeah.
It was maybe 24 minutes too long. I thought it was interesting. You could definitely see the different characters they're setting up to be huge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Along the span of the series. I thought the acting was touch and go.
Are you talking about the lead actor here, Avery
Sisko,
Brooks?
Sisko was good,
okay.
But the moments with his son were really forced, but that is tough, right, with kid actors?
Yeah. Sure.
A young Sirach, he was okay, I guess.
What do you think of the doctor in this episode?
That was horrible acting as well. I don't know what his background is. Is he Shakespearean, that guy? Is he
a stage actor?
He's a stage actor.
He's actually Malcolm McDowell's nephew.
No way.
Yeah.
I think he was kind of nervous. I didn't really see much.
I think it was on the page, maybe.
They said that they want him to be very naive. Yeah. The interesting thing is like that character changes so much by the end of the series that he's unrecognizable to me now going back and watching his pilot.
How many seasons?
Seven.
Seven seasons?
Yeah.
And was this Fox? Who was this?
It was syndicated. So it was like Hercules, Xena. It was just local affiliates would pick it up and run it whatever time. But you actually asked us, as we were pushing play, how does DS9 rank among Star Trek fans?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what is the perception out there? And I think you could say, well, okay, with the original series, it's kind of the classic one. You know, it is kind of often the litmus test for a lot of the other franchises to come after that. Next Generation had the biggest, most mainstream appeal, broadest audiences.
I would say TNG is kind of like the people's choice.
Yeah.
Like, if you ask sort of the average person who's watched some Star Trek, they're going to point to the Next Generation.
Yeah.
Unless they're really old. Then
sure.
They might say original.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And that was smart for the producers to piggyback on that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they got Stewart in there, and they got Cole Meany.
That becomes a trend going forward. Like, every time they do, I guess even before with TNG, they had McCoy at the front, but they always have a previous cast member show up in a pilot.
Yeah. Yeah. But Colm stuck it out all seven seasons.
He did, yeah.
But he needed the money.
Contract talks. He was actually close to getting killed off at the beginning of season 6. So that was the rumor going on at the time.
Why are the engineers always Scottish?
Well, he's actually Irish.
Oh, jeez.
So,
you've offended all of our Scottish listeners.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. But yes, what Deep Space Nine, like, how is it perceived? It's perceived as kind of the darker series, kind of almost the redheaded stepchild to a certain degree, but it's also, I would say, considered to be maybe the most prestigious series to a degree, the one that's most respected and that is ahead of its time when it comes to storytelling. Yeah. It was really the first serialized Star Trek series. It went into politics, religion, in a way that the other Star Trek series really did not want to get into. So it was very ahead of its time.
And a lot of character growth over the seven seasons. Like, every character has major arcs where, you know, they go through trials, tribulations, and then, you know, when you get to the end, they are completely different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something that Star Trek had never done, and if you look at just TV in general, had never done.
Yeah.
And this show also had very, very strong female characters, which, not common in 1990s television, and you look at TNG in the, you know, late 80s into the 90s, Troi and Crusher are underwritten a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and you have a black lead, which was pretty rare.
As the chosen
back
one.
Then. Yeah, it was great.
You know, the idea of a black man who's the chosen one, essentially, in like a hero's journey story, very, very unusual in 1993.
The very fact that he's the black man with a family that's not intact, but he's the one raising his kid, I think that was very important to Avery Brooks, this entire journey as well. But, you know, I do... There will be some spoilers here, I think. Mike, I don't anticipate you're going to run home and watch all 178 remaining episodes.
There's only 100 on Netflix, so I'm
exactly, I know.
We had a friend who watched the whole thing in, what, 2 weeks?
Something like that.
Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. What were they doing?
Her name's Shelley. She did it right before the Vegas con 1 year. She just burned through it in 2 weeks.
I think you convinced her, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I was responsible.
Shelley, are you still alive?
Are you stuck in the Aurora Borealis right now, Shelley? She's traveling Alaska as we speak.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah,
so, okay, the fascinating thing here. Well, you know, Kim, let's get into it. Let's start with what worked, because I think there's a lot we can pick apart with this episode, but let's start with the good stuff here. Kim, I think Mike alluded to it with the exposition, but it does set up kind of all the main players and how it's going to go from here on out. You're setting up the politics with... both Kaiopaka and the religion.
Kaiopaka, your favorite character.
My favorite character, yeah. Who's eventually written out because I think I've read it behind the scenes. The producers thought she was too ethnic, which was very kind of alarming.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, you're setting up the Kai, the Bajoran religious system. You're setting up the state of the Cardassians that had just left this occupied planet. You have the introduction of this wormhole, this, you know, gateway to the other side of the galaxy that plays a huge part throughout the course of the series. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think most important is just the way that they set up all the characters, their relationships. I mean, Mike, I think you were a little thrown off when Sisko started calling Jadzia old man, you know, and like those people had a relationship before, you know, when like the old man had that slug in his belly and all his memories are transferred over to Jadzia. So it's interesting that they were able to set up everything in a way like that. But Cam, did it work for you on the page more so than maybe on screen?
It is a very talky pilot.
Yeah.
Strangely, though, I actually found it way more entertaining the second time through.
Okay.
I think it's because I knew where it was going. So, you know, the first time through, you're like, what the heck am I watching? People are just nattering. Sisko's explaining time for 47 minutes.
Yes.
And I just remember being completely baffled, whereas watching it this time, it was like I could see bookmarks between this and the finale that the writers had carried forward. I knew the evolution of the characters, so it was fun watching to see how that was set up. You know, like even like the Quark-Odo scene in, you know, where they're bickering and Sisko's kind of breaking them up. Like, just seeing things like that was like so joyful to watch. But yes, it is very, very exposition heavy. I think... I don't know. Was there a way to make this not talky?
Yeah, well, do you know what I think the issue was, though, is I thought the first half of this two-parter is very well-paced until you get into the wormhole. Mm-hmm. And you're stuck with wormhole aliens, and then it just kind of comes to a screeching halt as Sisko's explaining how time works.
How does time work?
I kind of like that, though.
Okay.
Well, I just thought it was different, and...
Well, you know, it's very Star Trek-y.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is... I think they spent too much time
doing Yeah, that. They could have cut a couple minutes.
I like to think the 24 minutes was just that.
But I thought that was taken. Like, that was pretty innovative, the way that he's going through his memories and speaking to different characters in the same scene that just morph.
Well, mm-hmm.
That a lot of sci-fi movies afterwards took from that.
Yeah, Contact in 97, Robert Zemeckis movie. Okay, yeah with Jodie Foster. Yeah.
Do you know what makes this pilot stand out versus, say, Encounter at Farpoint, which is the series premiere of Star Trek The Next Generation? Encounter at Farpoint, very much story-focused. You could tell this is a very much character-focused pilot. You have Ben has a very clear arc throughout the course of this episode where he's has the loss of his wife at the very beginning, and he comes to grips with it by the end by speaking with the wormhole aliens, and he's ready to let go and take command. He didn't even want to take command of the station at the beginning of the episode when he's talking to Picard. By the end, he wants to stick around.
It helps that it's a dope station, though.
All of a sudden it is.
He's now the center of the Starfleet.
Yeah. If it was a crappy space outpost still, I don't know if he would have stuck around.
What do you call the wormhole aliens?
Well, okay, so the Bajorans call them the Prophets.
Okay.
And... just everyone else just calls them the wormhole aliens. They don't have like a real name. Kim, did they ever establish a name for the Bajoran faith?
No.
Or is it just called the Bajoran religion the whole time?
Yes, that's what it's called.
That's rather strange.
Had Raiders of the Lost Ark come out by then? Because I got that vibe.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
With the chalice and the sparkling chalice, and then Kai Opaka, the.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's even a very. Raiders of the Lost Ark inspired episode of Next Generation, in which we get to see Picard at his best when it comes to being an archaeologist.
It's not a good episode. But it's funny you mentioned earlier Encounter at Farpoint. This episode, this pilot, was actually, according to Michael Piller, pretty heavily modeled on Encounter at Farpoint. You had characters getting introduced like 40 minutes into the episode when, like, you know, Jadzia and Bashir show up late.
Right.
You're introducing kind of your central characters earlier on. And then it kind of ends in this big sort of philosophical discussion, like Picard, you know, debating human existence with Q in Encounter at Farpoint, and Sisko defending humanity to the wormhole aliens in the wormhole.
I think it makes sense, and it feels very Star Trek to
me.
So, but I do like the way that they paced the introductions of characters. You start off with Ben and his son, and actually the initial pitch of this from Brandon Tartikoff when he spoke to Michael Piller and Rick Berman.
Knowledge.
They were they were tasked with, you know, developing the series. He said, "All I picture is a man and boy in space," and they went off and developed it from there. Which I think it's interesting. They start with that, and it continues on throughout the rest of the series, but in a way that develops quite a bit. You know, Mike, we're gonna spoil a lot of stuff throughout this because I think.
Spoil away.
Cam, as you said, like, one of the fascinating things is to see where everybody starts and compare that with where everyone ends. And
right.
It's very different spots. I mean, if you're talking about just relationships that develop, you know, romantic or otherwise, as well as just, like, how people change jobs throughout. For example, do you recall that little thief, the nephew of the bartender at the beginning?
Yeah.
By the end of the series, he's actually has Chief O'Brien's job. Like, he takes over from Chief O'Brien.
Yeah.
For all you listeners, Mike's eyebrows just bounced up to the top of his forehead at this point.
So proud of him.
Yeah. and these are just minor characters who get, like, big arcs throughout the course of the series. And, like, it was unlike any other Star Trek series that came, you know, before that. And really, since then. As well.
Yeah, and Gul Dukat becomes probably the greatest villain in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So. He was in the J.J. Abrams.
No, he's just
wasn't
he? Purely
with the Cardassians in there.
They had a shout out in Star Trek Into Darkness, but not in the initial J.J. Abrams film that you caught. So,
have you guys read dissertations or PhDs or anything on the parallels between this universe and Earth?
Our history? I've written them.
Yeah. I read Tyler's.
Yeah.
They're at angelfire.com.
GeoCities.
Cam is actually referencing my old Star Trek Voyager website that featured my fan fiction.
Look for it with Ash
Jeeves. That is amazing. When did you start that?
When I was 12.
So,
Believe me, it's long disappeared.
Are we ever going to do a podcast episode where you just read it?
I should.
You should. Yeah, people do those embarrassing diary entries. They read them in public at, like, bars.
Yeah,
you should read, Read your
just down the street. Like, my girlfriend and I, we went to the Fox Cabaret, and we watched people read their teenage diaries.
Really?
Yeah. I should bring my teenage fan fiction.
Do it. Your dissertation.
Okay.
That would be amazing.
Who is your professor under which you...
Obviously, the greats. Cam Smith.
I want nothing to do with this.
No, it's just interesting. I mean, the different races and the different, you know...
Right.
Stakes they have on the galaxy.
Right.
The geopolitics, that was kind of...
Yeah, and they really, when they pitched this series, they really emphasized they want it to be a real Western. This is, the most Western of all Star Trek. And Star Trek has a lot of Western comparisons.
Yeah.
But, you know, this, you know, you've got, you know, Quark, who's the saloon keeper. You got Odo, who's like the sheriff. Kira's sort of like the aboriginal, whose land has been taken. You know, it kind of extends across. And
the doctor's performing frontier medicine, as he
tells. Exactly, yeah.
The native.
And they're in the runabout called the Rio Grande.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of allusions here going on. And it's funny because I feel like people don't look at Deep Space Nine as, like, the Western series. They look at it more as, like, the one more that's more relevant to the, like, political climate of today.
Yeah.
But it just shows that history repeats itself.
Well, yeah, one of the things that we should... bring up, I think, here is that the character of O'Brien, and I think the way that he's introduced, he's almost kind of a surrogate for the audience to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. He's in that first scene with Ben as he's going about the station, and I like how he just kind of stands in contrast so much to, say, Geordi as kind of the chief engineer. He literally kicks the console to get the transporter to work, and I think that represents, hey, all the problems they're going to have with this station, you know, using alien technology that's been stripped by the occupiers as well. And just that O'Brien's not like this big, I guess, like, astrophysicist sort of dude like Geordi is. Mm-hmm. So
that spaceship is a very convenient deus ex machina. You know, oh, there's a problem. Oh, we can't get the thrusters to work. Like, I'm sure throughout the episodes, right? That
kind never of, happens again.
Yeah. Like, don't you get frustrated at that being kind of like a propeller of the plot?
It gets formulaic, believe me. And, you know, and I think especially, do you think the worst is during Voyager?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just kind of every episode climaxes with a scene on the bridge.
Right.
In which phasers are being fired.
Although there was a scene in this, actually, that I appreciate, where it started with a little bit of techno babble about how they're going to, you know, stand up to the Cardassians. And then it goes into real English, like, where they're explaining it in a way that the audience would understand.
Yeah.
Which is something that I think DS9 was fairly good about. It wasn't too techno babble heavy as compared to TNG or Voyager.
I think you definitely watch Next Generation. And I'm always shocked by the amount of technobabble that was going on throughout this, especially compared to Deep Space Nine, where they really tried to just... This is why I appreciate Michael Piller coming in and being like the co-creator here, is because he has such a character focus, as opposed to just making it story focus. When Ira Steven Baer comes in as well, he's the one who really gets like serialized storytelling going, but he sticks with the characters as well.
Right.
And with that, he gives these characters a lot of great arcs as well. So Ira Steven Baer, he was there from day one, essentially. He didn't have a writing credit on this one, but he was brought in purposely by Michael Piller, you know, to co-run it, at least for the first few seasons.
Well, he was behind Apocalypse Rising, wasn't he? That episode? 20 years ago today.
Oh.
I was like, oh my god, Hager is dropping Star Trek science here.
There's a calendar behind us, and it's got all the episodes. That's amazing. Deep Space Nine, Apocalypse Rising, Friday, September 30th.
One of the things that I do want to bring up as well when we talk about O'Brien is that we did get a Setlick 3 shout-out. Did you appreciate that, Cameron?
I did, very much so. Mike, did you appreciate that?
I know a lot of this is just going on.
I would have
like,
liked a Setlick 4, but I'll do the 3. What is Setlick 3?
Well, I mean, O'Brien was a soldier before he became kind of an engineer, and his backstory, a lot of it we discover in like the mid-seasons of Next Generation, which he was... involved the Cardassian Wars, and so is the Setlick 3 massacre. It was just a very traumatizing experience for O'Brien, and he has big issues with the Cardassians. So that's another genius thing, is that he was able to be brought into this series where he has existing conflict with the Cardassians. Because, Mike, I think the other
thing... Can we stop talking about the Cardassians? They gain in power every time we chat about them.
I know.
The whole world's talking about them. They don't need any more attention. These Cardassians, man.
Well, look, I mean, we had the first Cardassian selfie, and there all those view screen scenes going on earlier.
Right. Yeah, and Gul Dukat broke the internet.
Yep.
Yeah, he was the first one.
Anyhow, I had to... That threw me when I first heard the Cardassians.
Right.
O'Brien, is he pretty central to the whole arc of Deep Space Nine?
That's an interesting thing, because out of all the characters, Cam, I think you might be completing my thought.
Well, it's funny because O'Brien kind of gets the Tasha Yar treatment in this pilot, where you watch and you're like, man, O'Brien's going to be the star of this show, kind of like he did with Tasha Yar in Encounter at Farpoint. Going forward, like, there's episodes O'Brien isn't even on.
Yeah.
And he's, at the end of the day, O'Brien is sort of the static character. Like, he has changed, but he's maybe changes the least by the journey.
I just think he was such a well-developed character going in. They knew exactly what they wanted from him. And, yeah. Look, this guy was probably the most tormented character in all of Star Trek. Like, he, went through the ringer, Mike. They had a torture O'Brien episode at least once or twice a season.
Sure.
So, but
that was in his contract.
I think it was.
What else did he do on the side? Was he acting on the side? Is that why he...
Yeah, he was.
Because he kind of blew up for a while.
Yeah.
He shot Con Air.
Yeah, exactly.
During what, season, five, I guess, maybe? Four or five?
Something like that. Yeah. He also did a lot of Irish films at the time. So, he was actually busy with...
Isn't he in the Boondock Saints?
No, he was not. But,
okay, sorry.
The Commitments, I think.
Oh, wow.
Sure. I don't really know.
He was in The Van.
Right.
So there you go.
An actual van. That's how much residuals on DS9 pay.
The Van was this Irish film where I think he was selling fish and chips with a buddy. And they're...
Are we talking about real life, Tyler?
Hey, no, Colin Meaney is still one of the bigger success stories coming out of Deep Space Nine.
That's the only one I recognize.
Let's talk about the performances, because you say he's one of the biggest names out of here. There are some cast members in this show who are amazing, give some of the best performances in the history of Star Trek.
And does this pilot episode give you an idea of what's to come?
I want
to
know, Mike, if you're watching, you just watched this pilot, who would you say, let's say maybe the three characters you think going forward you would predict as being maybe the three heavy hitters of the series?
If you don't remember their
names, you can just... what's her name?
Kira.
Kira.
Mm-hmm.
She was a good actor. You could see her being kind of pivotal. You could see some development from Sisko.
Mm-hmm.
You see him leading it.
Right.
More effectively after those kind of clunky scenes with his son.
It's great when Avery Brooks directs himself in episodes.
Yeah, Kevin Costner or Sly Stallone? What are we talking?
Maybe more like William Shatner directing himself.
I don't know. Far Beyond the Stars is pretty amazing. So
absolutely. I think one of the issues people had with Avery Brooks, I think a lot of people found him very polarizing, like his performance. I personally liked it, but some people would accuse it of being maybe over the top at times. Like, he yells a lot. But okay, you have one more character to pick out of this litter here.
And Odo, too.
Okay.
Those are pretty solid picks, actually. Yeah, this pilot does a decent job of setting up probably the three most important characters.
Yeah, and it's surprising because as we go through the series, we'll see how Odo is so integral to the overall story arc, and I don't know if you would have guessed that just based on this particular episode.
He alluded to his past.
Exactly. Yeah. And we figure out that he did come from the other side of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And the species that he originates from, they're actually these totalitarian species that kind of run their own sort of anti-federation, and that they eventually invade this side of the galaxy through that wormhole.
Spoiler!
So, I know, but it's interesting to see how his conflict, his internal conflict, is going between his own species and the people that he has loyalty to. And I think we're getting at a very key thing with Deep Space Nine versus Next Generation. The whole point of Next Generation is that Gene Roddenberry did not want there to be conflict between Starfleet officers in the 24th century. He said humans have evolved past that. And so the writers were always trying to find ways to write around that. So in Deep Space Nine, we have the introduction of a lot of non-Starfleet characters. We've got Quark the bartender. We have Odo and Kira, who are part of the Bajoran militia. We have Jake, who's just a civilian. Mm-hmm. And then we have a couple, like, random Starfleet officers.
And you also have guest characters like Garak show up later.
There are a lot of guest characters throughout this series that introduce a lot of conflict, a lot of internal conflict that was missing in Star Trek The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. So this is a really interesting exercise, and they're starting with the internal conflict right away.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and I actually really enjoyed that aspect of it, watching it this time, you know, watching, like, Kira snap at Bashir about his frontier medicine and the adventure and all that sort of stuff. It's like, ah, yes. You know, Kira's probably my favorite character in the history of Star Trek.
Whoa. And,
yeah, I know. It's quite
crush early on.
Oh, believe me. Oh, yes.
What, that modified nose? You like that?
Mike, you need to see photos that Cam's taken with the actress at conventions.
What's her name?
Nana Visitor. And each photo is worse than the previous one.
I did like how they called her Sir.
Right.
I noticed that.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever watch Battlestar Galactica, Mike?
No.
Okay. Like the rebooted version.
I watched one episode. I couldn't get with it. I just...
Okay.
The Cylons, is that what they're called?
Cylons, yeah.
Cylons, yeah, it was kind of clunky as well.
The funny thing about, like...
Is she in that? Sorry.
Yeah, she...
Sorry, Cam.
No. She does appear in that, but what I was getting at is that Battlestar Galactica, it's almost like Deep Space Nine Raw in a certain way. Like, one of the main writers from Deep Space Nine ended up going on to Battlestar Galactica to develop that. But they do have the female president, who they keep referring to as, like, Sir... Yeah.
Okay. So, what were you saying?
I was going to say about the interesting thing about Kira, who I think is at least the best written character in DS9, is that the show wasn't even going to feature her in the first place.
Yeah.
It was going to feature a character named Ensign Roe, who was on TNG in quite a few episodes. And that was the only reason it involved Bajor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the actress, Michelle Forbes, was like, no, I'm not signing a contract. I don't really want to do a regular gig. And so Kira was created, and so it's sort of out of the accident, we get what turns into probably the best written character in the history of the franchise.
And it brings up a lot of questions. Yeah. Like,
bold statement.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, you could...
Bold.
Look, I may not agree with it fully, but I would respect it.
Who's the best written?
Best written? So I'm going to have to go with Deep Space Nine. I'm going to go with my favorite character, and the reason why he works is because...
Vedic Brow?
Because... He works it. Yeah.
He does work it.
No, I'll go with, look, this might seem like an obvious pick for a lot of hardcore DS9 fans, but I think that Garak, who did not appear in the pilot episode, Garak's, I think, such a nuanced character, very much just a very gray character morally. You never know where you stand with him, but he's essentially the only Cardassian left on the station, and so we're introduced to him in the second episode of the series. And he's just there as, like, a plain, simple tailor. But you do find out that he's, in fact, a former spy. So his allegiances are called into question, especially when, like I said, that invading force from the other side of the galaxy comes.
Hmm.
And the Cardassians actually align with that invading force after their empire's been decimated by the Klingons. So there's a lot of storylines going on that you wouldn't necessarily expect just based on this pilot episode.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we don't have Worf yet, because Worf shows up later and becomes a regular on the series too. Worf from TNG. So, yeah, there's a ton of characters on this show. I was curious, Mike, how did it feel seeing Picard on the show?
I just knew that he was there to boost the ratings and try and draw viewers in, right?
How did
that continuity.
Right. How did you feel watching him sort of opposite Avery Brooks?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, he killed his wife, and you know, there's a bit of tension. It was a bit overblown.
Was it overblown?
I just acting wise between the two. I don't know.
Here's what they bring up, though. I'm reading my Star Trek Deep Space Nine companion.
Right at this very moment.
At this very moment. No, but in researching this pilot episode, and they brought up the fact that they don't want like a passing of the baton. Where it's just like a pat on the back.
That was clear, yeah.
Yeah, like...
There's a Fisher, just...
Exactly, because it would...
get a new captain in town.
It would be expected
that... sheriff, if you will.
Well, yeah, I think that was originally kind of the idea how the relationship between Quark and Sisko is going to be, where essentially Quark's a troublemaker, Sisko is the sheriff, but then they realize he can't have, like, this barkeeper bugging the station commander. So that's why they created Odo, essentially, mm-hmm. to fill that role. But
I thought that was hilarious that he walks through and there's like, it's a den of iniquity. He's like, oh yeah, things are back to normal. People are gambling and drinking and who knows what else.
What did you think of the instrument with the guy pounding on rocks?
That's probably about as good as I could play any other instrument. I don't know. Okay. It wasn't too bad. It was very interesting.
I take lessons for that on weekends.
Yeah, you'll perform it this year at the next convention, I should say.
What is it called? What is that instrument?
Don't ask me that.
I stumped him!
Getting back to Picard, I was actually really impressed at the writing of Picard in this episode, especially compared to, like, McCoy in the TNG premiere.
Sure.
Like, this was a huge step up in how to actually write a character from another series into the show and make them feel valuable to what's going on as opposed to, well, you know, have fun.
I know, because you could have totally gotten away without that McCoy cameo in Encounter at Farpoint.
And going forward, some of the others in the pilots.
I think we could have lost Seth from Cochrane quite easily.
Yeah.
But with this, I mean, it's so central to Ben's arc throughout this episode as well. So I think, you know, convincing Patrick Stewart to take a big payday and get back in that Locutus of Borg makeup.
I was going to ask, do you think he was, or do you think they reused all footage?
No, I'm pretty sure that he did.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I've read it somewhere. And I think he got paid a lot.
Well, I read they dropped a lot of money on this pilot. Herman Zimmerman, the production designer, said they spent more on this pilot than they did on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. According to him.
Okay.
I don't know.
I don't believe that's true.
No?
The reason
I thought maybe was because they would have had to build a lot more sets versus recycling Star Trek VI.
Yeah, yeah. What I do know, though, is that at the time, this was the most expensive pilot ever made for television.
Right.
And I only think that that record was broken by Lost when it premiered in 2006, Jesus. I believe. Hmm. So, there you go. But I think, just based on, look, that Battle of Wolf 359 scene, that took a lot of change out of their petty cash tour.
Sure.
Certainly.
Which one was that?
That was the opening sequence with the Borg attack. You know?
Yes.
Hey, were you familiar with the Borg all that much?
Yes.
You know?
I refer to the Donnelly Group as the Borg in Vancouver. They're all consuming.
We had a big issue with the Donnelly Group, I guess maybe 2 weeks ago.
Did we?
Yeah, we vowed we were never going to go back to that one particular bar.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway. No, it's definitely well known. I mean, that's a cultural touchstone, the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
Use that of... I know all about the Borg.
Okay.
I don't know where they end up in the
you don't want to know.
Star Trek.
Don't
Pantheon.
Ask. It involves children.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I think, guys, if there's anything that we want to touch upon that worked before we go on to maybe what didn't work, any closing thoughts here on this topic, Cameron?
I really liked the reveals about Odo's shape changing.
Yeah.
Look, the CG's a little wonky these days.
Sure.
But I did appreciate. You know, that scene where the thief throws the thing at Odo's head, goes right through his head.
A mace to the face.
Yeah, and you also get to see later on him as the bag turning back into his humanoid form. Very T-1000.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, does that happen without that movie coming out? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I've just rewatched the X-Files, and the CGI didn't look too bad.
Yeah.
In these episodes, compared to the X-Files. The X-Files was horrible. That was even later.
The oily blood coming out of people's eyes.
Yeah. And the UFO scenes are just...
Yeah, it's true. Like, I think this pilot, production-wise, actually holds up pretty good.
I think the big issue here, though, is, like, the transfer. It's really bad quality. They really need to get a new transfer for this.
Come on, Netflix.
Well, you know, Cam spoke to Ira Stephen Bear, the showrunner for the final, five seasons of Deep Space Nine?
Yeah.
And... Cam essentially said, hey, my friend Tyler, he's really holding out hope for those Blu-rays. Are they ever going to come? Ira Stephen Bear said, what exactly?
Well, what happens, I said, should he just take the plunge and just buy the DVDs because he wants the series, or should he buy the Blu-ray?
What about the Laserdiscs? I'm sure they're out there.
They might be. Yeah, they might be.
But his answer was, don't give up hope, wait for the Blu-rays.
So,
there is no word on Blu-rays ever coming out, so I don't know.
It's just this transfer looks so awful, though, and I know that this would have aged even better had we watched it on a much superior transfer than this.
Yeah. A nice TV, too. I mean,
yeah.
A nice TV.
That actually works against you. I think you want a crappier TV, and they probably look better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my guess.
There's just moments where it's pixelated. Yeah. And
DVDs look a little better, I'll say.
Okay.
A little.
We were watching this on Netflix, by the way. Yeah. Listeners.
So. One thing I wanted to get to, actually, is, you know, we talked earlier about Gul Dukat.
Yeah.
Mike, you get the impression, seeing Gul Dukat, that this would be a really cool character going forward, or you just feel kind of like baddie of the week?
Right.
He had a bit of nuance, yeah. He was diplomatic, you know, trying to be menacing while being diplomatic. So you see a bit of opportunity there. Like, his comrade who confronted them when he was in...
Gul Chased.
Wow. Is Gul honorific? Is that like Mr.?
It's like Captain.
Captain.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, he was just like cardboard thin.
Sure.
Yeah.
He doesn't make another appearance.
Yeah, just overacting. It was, you know, it was cheesy.
Well,
but, I can see some potential there.
It was actually a different actor who was originally hired to play Gul Dukat, and they decided it just was not working with that actor, and so they went back to Mark.
Deep space knowledge.
Oh, thank you. They went back to Mark Alamo. He had played other characters on Star Trek The Next Generation.
With a bunch of makeup.
Exactly. And he actually played the first Cardassian ever featured, which is the same species here, except he had, like, kind of these mutton chops. So I guess
you have, like,
that
gray
was...
gray hair here?
They could have been, yeah. But I guess Gul Maset and Gul Dukat are supposed to be cousins or something like that. Canon.
Sure.
So they liked this actor enough to, you know, bring him back, think that he was reliable, and he became the primary antagonist throughout the series. His arc kind of
it peters out by about season 6, and you get a whole season 7 of him where it's like they didn't really know what to do with him. But for at least the first 6 seasons, he is. A phenomenal character.
And he goes on such a journey where he goes from this antagonist to this, you know, almost reluctant ally back to an antagonist once again.
That's great. It's great, right? But he didn't seem like a political leader. So you knew there's someone above him, I guess.
Sure.
So you weren't ultimately worried that he could destroy... you know, or take on the Starfleet or whoever.
Well, like, his occupation of Bajor was kind of seen as a failure. He was actually a legate, and then he had been demoted back to Gul. So legate is like an admiral. Gul, captain. What's underneath that? Is that a Glynn?
Sure.
Okay.
And then an Uda.
I'll go with that. I don't know if what the rank is beneath Glynn.
I don't know either.
Okay, well, there you go.
That's interesting. If you're a bit character... you can just cycle through so many episodes because you're wearing makeup, right? Like, how many actors? I bet it's a pool that they would select from.
Well, there's a very good example in this. The Vulcan captain featured at the very start of this episode.
Lurch.
Lurch. He actually comes back as a very important recurring character starting in season 4, one General Martok.
Klingon?
Klingon.
What?
Yeah.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
Do people get mad at conventions? Like,
no.
You're switching races like that?
People like it even more.
Yeah.
Like, if you get photos with him, it's 2-for-1. You know?
Will they do, like, one day, they'll do one and then the other?
With J.G. Hertzler, who played that Vulcan captain, he's actually very popular at the conventions because he dresses up in his Klingon makeup, and people, not Cam and I, enjoy it quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the character, the Martok, the Klingon character, is far more popular than this character.
Yeah.
The character that... Did he say anything? I guess he did a couple things, but not much. He's not particularly well-regarded for this particular episode.
So but, Quark is who I remembered as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Right, yes. I feel like at that time, he was the character that appealed to kids.
No one had seen a Ferengi before, I don't think.
Well, they've been on TNG, but they were not cool.
No.
Yeah.
Quark has sort of like a... It's like they kind of refine the look a little bit, just a little bit, enough where he just kind of pops, I think, in a way that they never did before. And there's something about Quark that's very cool that I would never say about any other Ferengi on TNG.
Well, we discussed this in our episode, Cam, Bad Boys of Star Trek.
Right.
And we decided that Quark was the bad boy of Deep Space Nine, and one of the things that we measured that on is just his luck with the ladies as well. And, you know, like, he does have a lot of luck.
Not banking off the looks, you know.
Well, it's...
Personality.
Personality.
He's got game. He inspired the villain, one of them, in Sin City. It looked like a lot of the visuals.
Old Yellow Bastard.
Yeah, there you go.
There is a similar look.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I can see it.
Yeah, Rob, sure. The big forehead and the big bulbous nose face.
We have to track down Frank Miller and ask him about that.
Okay. What's Pillar's career arc? What did he write? He's taking you way off track.
He came on to season 3 TNG, right? And really defined what that series was. First two seasons are really rocky. And then he kind of becomes the master child and, you know, really leads TNG into what it becomes. And then jumps onto DS9 and then jumps over to Voyager.
What has he done before and since?
Well, before that, what did he work on? Was it, like, Equalizer or something like that?
Yeah, it was a few...
It was, like, some of these, like, typical, like, 80s dramas, you know, and...
No sci-fi elements.
No, he wasn't a sci-fi guy before this. Huh. He was very much, like, a character-oriented writer. And so, after Star Trek, he went and co-created some other kind of sci-fi shows that aired for a while. I guess, what was it? The Dead Zone that he developed?
Yeah.
You know? And he came back and he wrote one Star Trek film that is not highly regarded. But he actually died quite young. I think he was a brain cancer or something. Yeah, so I think he was maybe 55 or something when he passed away. But was his widow not at this year's Star Trek convention?
I don't know.
I think she was in the vendor's room, like, doing autographs for some book that she penned all about Michael Pillar.
Right. So,
but he's the guy, like, he's really, as Cam said, the one that kind of redefined modern Star Trek for what it is, making it more about the characters as opposed to the aliens of the week, which we had very much in the first two seasons of Next Generation.
Right. So. And so, like, you do not get to a show like Deep Space Nine without Michael Pillar coming on and kind of kicking TNG in season 3.
Respect to Michael Pillar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So, guys, why don't we talk a little bit about maybe what does not work?
Right.
And I'll go... I think it's a very obvious thing, but Cam, let me ask you this. What's the inciting incident? Because I think that's key for all, like, dramas, whether it's a novel or a script or anything like that. Tell me what the inciting incident is, and tell me approximately at what time does it begin in this episode.
Well, in this, it's... I mean, kind of the death of Sisko's wife, because that's ultimately what the resolution is about.
Really? Okay, I did not think that was the inciting incident. I would have thought is essentially the discovery of the wormhole.
Sure.
That took, like, 45 minutes
but
to get to.
But isn't that more of about the what leads to the resolution?
What the...
The discovery of the wormhole is ultimately what creates the solution to Sisko's sort of character arc in this episode.
Yeah.
Yes. So I would say the incident is actually the death of the wife, because that's the story that's being told.
Okay, I'll disagree with that. I don't think the death of Jennifer Sisko is the inciting incident.
Not of the series, but I would say of this episode.
Of this episode? Okay. Mike, what do you think the inciting incident is?
I don't want to get in between you two guys. This is an intense argument here. I don't want it to be like the 50th anniversary episode. You listeners out there, you probably wanted to intervene through the speakers. These two are at each other, I hear.
Well, okay. It's
are you guys okay now? Are you over that?
We've mended fences after we both realized we were wrong about the box office numbers we were arguing about.
Don't you have Google?
We try to keep phones out of this.
Yeah.
But, so Cam, if that's the case, like, you don't necessarily think it took a while for kind of the drama to start going in this one?
You know what?
Because I thought there was just a lot of exposition.
I would bet you the first time I watched this, I agreed with you that I was waiting for something to happen.
Okay.
Rewatch it, though, that's what I felt like. Okay, well, this is the story they're telling.
Okay.
That's kind of, so it's kind of changed revisiting it.
I definitely see where you're coming from when you say that the death of Jennifer is the inciting incident, you know, but to me is just more kind of the expository part of the episode, that it's just like set up for what's coming here. And I think really, like, maybe I could just be viewing this through the prism of the fact that I know that the wormhole is so central to the plot of the series.
Yes.
You know? I just thought that it just took we had like 45 minutes of, like, I thought very well-paced exposition and setup. We have the introduction of the wormhole, which is the inciting incident, and then I think it kind of comes to, like, a bit of a crashing halt with all those scenes, a lot of scenes inside the wormhole.
Right. Yeah, you see, for me, it kind of works because ultimately, you know, the show starts, Sisko's wife has died, then he's, you know, not happy to be at Deep Space Nine. His entire journey is about making peace with that this is his place to be. Series can start.
Sure.
So that's sort of the story. Like, I think I actually enjoyed it more following that character, like the Sisko's journey in this one, you know, or 90-minute episode than looking at it as, well, how does this rank as, you know, the kickoff to DS9, other than just seeing characters introduced?
He was about to leave the fleet.
Yes, he was.
Yep. He was going to go civilian.
Yeah. Which, in the Star Trek universe, like, it's kind of thought of only, like, losers are civilians.
Right.
You know, like, it's the be-all, end-all to be a Starfleet officer.
What's Earth like in these series?
Well, Earth is very kind of a utopian paradise, and my favorite quote in Ira Steven Bear, he recited it at the convention. The whole central dilemma with, like we said, you know, the lack of conflict between human characters in the 24th century. Well, there's an episode of Deep Space Nine where Sisko says, it's easy to be a saint when you're in paradise. And he's talking about the situation on Earth, where things are a lot trickier if you're on the frontier, and you have to bend the rules a lot more, and can't necessarily abide by all those wonderful human ideals that they might have in a very peaceful place.
Like, how often does he go back? Does he ever go back in Deep Space Nine?
I think he went back twice throughout the run of the series.
Sounds about right.
In the Surge Part 1, or is that when he went back?
No, he went back, I think Mike's still looking at the calendar. But,
you're just like, what?
No, but Odo goes home.
Oh, really?
No, he...
In the Search Part 1?
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
Whoa!
Yeah, wow.
Do you know all 170?
I just remember, like, that one in particular. That's a really key episode.
That's amazing.
Which is why it's on the calendar.
Sisko goes home in Homefront and Paradise Lost.
Right.
And then he goes home again at the season 6 finale, Tears of the Prophets, when Jadzia is killed by Gul Dukat.
Right.
Spoiler alert. Mike's stunned. He doesn't know if he can go on with knowing that Jadzia died.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's get to another character you mentioned earlier, Bashir.
Okay.
Now, you know, it's funny. I don't think I was offended by Bashir the first time I saw this. I think I just kind of was like, yeah, whatever. You know. The rewatch it though, I was really going like, what were they doing? Because I know where Bashir winds up. I know how rich a character he becomes.
And you know the actor's actually like really quite
good.
Capable.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I was wondering, a thought popped into my head watching this. The presentation of him is sort of this like stammering kind of nerdy guy. And I was wondering, was this inspired by Hugh Grant? Because this would have been right at the period where Hugh Grant was really big.
That's why I hate him.
Okay.
That's why I really don't like this character.
Maybe.
In the pilot.
And that was kind of flashing through my head. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. A stammering British...
Kind of young guy. Yeah. Kind of a little bit nerdy, but kind of that man kind of look.
Hopeless when, romantic trying to...
Yeah.
When did 9 Months come out?
Oh, that was 95. That was later.
Okay, but wasn't that supposed to be Hugh Grant's big breakthrough role that never really surfaced, though?
I mean, 3 Weddings and a Funeral. Was the big one.
Was that in 93?
I thought it was 94. No, maybe it was. Yeah. So, did this predate Hugh Grant?
I think, honestly, Dr. Julian Bashir set up the entry of Hugh Grant to North American audiences.
So we have him to thank.
Yeah, obviously.
Foppish British leading man. Great.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Here's the thing. The Michael Piller, he's gone on record saying that they wanted to show a character who was wet behind the ears, who was very green, arrogant, and they wanted to give him a very delineated character arc.
Right.
I say mission success because, like, this guy's changed. Do you think he changed more than any other character from pilot episode to the final episode?
I'd say Jesse had changed the most.
Fair enough. Spoiler alert, Mike. After Jadzia dies, another Trill symbiont is, like, put into another actress, and then she comes back to play Ezri Dax.
For season 7.
For season 7. Okay. So there you go. So that's what...
Trillium... What do you call it?
A Trill. Like, that's the name of the species.
Right. Yeah.
So they've got these symbionts.
They just need a host.
Exactly.
Well, who was the host that she originally had?
That was the old man. That was Curzon Dax.
But then how did they get that body of that woman? Jadzia's body. How did they find her and say, all right, you're going to be the host?
There's like this big sort of academy and training thing that, like, not all Trills are successfully accepted to be hosts for symbionts. So you have to go through a lot of training to do this. You have to be accepted into the program, be psychologically, you know, prepared for this. So Jadzia spent a lot of time, you know, preparing for this. So,
and it's funny because the Trill are introduced in the episode The Host of TNG.
And
they looked a little different then.
Very different, yes.
And when they were going to make DS9, the producers felt that Terry Farrell, the actress who plays Jadzia, was too attractive to cover up in makeup.
So
there you go. That's how we got the the Trill that we know and love now with the spots on the forehead and what have you.
Is that part of what doesn't work for you, Cam?
No, that works. Okay. I'm fine with it. I like the Trill. I like this version of the Trill more.
They really based it more on the look of the title character from the episode The Perfect Mate with those spots.
Right.
So, although the spots go in a different direction in this one versus the other one.
Yeah.
So there you go.
You're smirking. Which direction, Cam? <I don't...
laughs> No, the spots go on the Trills. They go on their front, as we saw them running down the front of her. Whereas in The Perfect Mate, the spots featured on those aliens, they go down their backs.
Right.
So this is fascinating to Michael Hager, I can tell.
No, I didn't.
So did anything else not work for you guys?
Well, I do wonder about the old-timey baseball uniforms that were featured here.
Sure.
Why not some high-tech baseball uniforms? Some 21st century baseball.
We do not need a Back to the Future 2 look at the future.
Well, and Cisco back in that day wouldn't have been allowed to play with
that's true.
The white players.
Yeah. Call.
Well, there were Negro leagues, and then there were the other leagues.
Yeah.
We do know that Michael Piller is a huge fan of baseball, and that's why we have all these references throughout the series. Even there's even an episode all about Jake and Nog going to search for a Willie Mays rookie card for Ben.
This is right after Field of Dreams. Piller kind of was inspired.
Must have been. Kevin Costner.
P. Kinsella, R.I.P.
Yeah.
What did work for me was the laser tag arena look of the Promenade.
Yeah.
I felt like I was back in my adolescence.
It's funny.
Zipping around.
It's very 90s.
It is very 90s, but I really actually appreciated the look of Deep Space Nine watching it now. In comparison to Star Trek The Next Generation, you could really see they were making their mission statement clear. Like, this was dirty, grungy Star Trek versus sort of that hotel lobby Star Trek.
An Aliens vibe.
Yeah. It was very lived in, very beaten up. But yes, it does look a little bit like a laser tag ring.
I mean, it is interesting that if you look at the sets of Star Trek The Next Generation, it's very 80s. You look at DS9, it looks very 90s. And I do think that Enterprise looks very, early aughts as well. So they're all kind of products of whatever time period.
When was Voyager?
Voyager was mid to late 90s. I guess, no, it ended early, 2001, I think?
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah, so, but I am fascinated how Star Trek Discovery is going to look, because as we've discussed on the podcast before, Brian Fuller, he is a very visually oriented writer. So the fact that he's going to bring his visual aesthetic to Star Trek, I'm fascinated by.
They have a TV show or a movie?
It's coming out, yes, in May.
Which, with Netflix?
Television
or with
series.
Netflix.
No,
CBS All Access.
Well,
in the States.
Netflix internationally, except for Canada. It's going to be Crave TV in Canada and Netflix all over the globe, except down in the States, it'll be CBS All Access.
Who's starring?
We don't know anything at this point.
What? It was supposed to start in January, but it's been pushed to May, so they're still...
Where are they filming?
Toronto.
Toronto.
Yeah.
Any Canadian Canuck content there?
I would assume that they're, just for, tax purposes, you're going to get at least one Canadian in the cast. We've already had Shatner and one Nicole DeBoer.
Yeah.
Why not another one?
Are we going to get Sirach back?
I hope so.
We can only hope. no matter how good it looks, 20 years from now, people will make fun of it for looking of its time.
Yeah, well, that's what I do wonder. But
that's a Star Trek curse.
But what do you think about, say, the bridge set of the Enterprise A from Star Trek VI, though? Do you think that looks of its time?
A little bit, yeah.
Does it? Okay, I thought that one has aged quite well.
I think all Star Trek has aged. I don't know that there's anything I would say has really been timeless.
Well, okay, but for me, the bridge, the Enterprise E, that looks very mid-90s to me.
Sure, yeah.
But I think the Enterprise A bridge looks very, non-linear to a certain degree. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, sure.
I think the J.J. Abrams...
Non-linear, you say, huh?
I know.
Are we good?
Whoa!
I know.
Everything is cyclical, my friend.
So if we're going to talk about what doesn't work, getting back to Emissary, are we going to talk about the wormhole sequence?
Sure, like I said, old-timey baseball uniforms.
Right.
You said, Mike, that it worked for you. It was interesting. But did you find it at least slow?
Very slow. I like the storytelling technique, though.
Yeah.
When he went through his his memories of flashbacks and talk. And I thought that was something that you didn't see until The Matrix or movies of that nature in the 2000s.
To me, I like the philosophical aspect of it. It works from a Star Trek perspective. I just think it dragged, and like they really could have cut that down.
It does feel like extended to a point where it doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
Like, the explanation of time was definitely dragged out. Like, they could have maybe mined some more, maybe emotional material out of it, instead of having him explain time for what feels like 10 minutes.
Let me throw this at you guys. Okay, so if the wormhole aliens have a non-linear existence, why does Ben Sisko even need to go through this whole facade of explaining time to them? Would they not have already experienced that? Or are we just seeing all of this through Ben's point of view?
Well, it's definitely through Ben's point of view. I'm just going to go with that.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Why
did he have to bother doing it if they would have already come to understand how he perceives the universe, since they don't have any perception of past, present, future? Right?
They wouldn't be able to understand if they hadn't seen it through his eyes.
But, like, as far as they know, as soon as he appears there, he had already given the explanation.
That is an excellent point. Oh, yeah. He's flying around about through those plot holes.
Jesus.
Yes. Oh.
Just got it. We're with you now.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know. I really
that is
don't.
An excellent question.
Yeah.
It's for him.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I think, Cam, the thing that we've always tried to do with all these two-parters is justify whether or not it should be a two-part episode.
Yeah.
Does this feel like it could have worked as a one-part episode if they had condensed enough stuff? Or do you think, you know, we needed all of the setup that we have here?
I think you needed it. I think had you condensed all this exposition to one episode and tried to set up the whole series off 45 minutes, it would have been a train wreck.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I didn't know this was split up originally when it aired.
No, it was aired as one whole.
As
we're just saying as an extended episode.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Because... Well, I should say, like, we just went through all the TNG two-parters, and also we did the one original series two-parter. And we've had an ongoing debate, just as, do any of these extended episodes need to be extended episodes? And we've found more often than not the answer is no. They needed to be 45 minutes, possibly.
Yeah.
And we also find, like, part two, more often than not, is, like, very weak compared with part one.
Yeah.
So, and I kind of felt that this is the same here, like... Part two was definitely weaker than part one.
I would agree with that. But I do think this one holds together. It actually has an overarching theme to it. It doesn't introduce things and then just drop them for part two.
Much more so than, say, Unification.
Sure, yes.
They were entrenched, Cam.
Yes, damn sure they were. Yeah.
All right.
So you agree, or?
I agree.
And Tyler?
Should be a two-parter?
Do you think two-parter?
I say, honestly, yes, it would have been a train wreck, Cam, if this was just a one-part episode. But I do wonder, okay, so, Mike, from TNG onwards, all the premiere episodes have been a two-part episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they set up the whole universe, the characters.
Mm-mm.
I think it's going to be tough as we go through, say, Voyager and Enterprise to say that they don't deserve to be two-part episodes.
Right.
But with Star Trek Discovery, do you think it's going to be a one-part episode or a two-part episode? I think, honestly, it's going to be a one-hour-long episode. I don't think
back to the original series.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's going to be a two-part-long episode.
Blame Twitter and Instagram for everyone's attention spans.
Well, here's the thing. Star Trek really wasn't serialized before, so it made sense to do a two-part premiere. Whereas if every episode is serialized of Discovery, then you don't need to do a...
That's what I think. Like, they'll take their time explaining the universe, explaining the characters.
It won't be the pressure to get all the pieces in place. You can just kind of...
Well, especially since, like, the whole model is built around binge-watching. Like, that's what they want to do. And that's why CBS is going to be pushing them to have this serialized arc that Brian Fuller has already confirmed is going on.
Right.
So,
One other weak thing I wanted to get to before we kind of close this off, and this is something that I hinted at last week when we were kind of talking about this episode, and that is the scenes of Sisko on the beach. Avery Brooks is perhaps the most idiosyncratic actor in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah, I'd agree.
He is going full on those beach scenes.
Just hooting and hollering when he realizes he's with Jennifer.
Yeah, but in an awkward, weird way.
That's how I talk to potential mates on the beach.
Does your girlfriend know about this?
That's how we met.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it worked. I spilled lemonade all over her.
Why do you have three glasses, though?
Hey, that's part of my whole technique of, like, meeting women on the beach.
And I think the problem
in a very
here
revealing bottom.
I think the problem, too, is that the actress who plays Jennifer Sisko is not strong.
How much can she bench?
She's a little blank. And he is this explosion of thespian power.
But does she redeem herself in the Mirror Universe?
No, she does not.
Okay.
We've talked about that one for sure in our Mirror Universe episode. So yeah, these beach scenes, I remember the first time I watched this, I was like, oh, this is awful.
I know, you were texting me and complaining about it.
Was
quite
it
a bit.
Was it the cinematography as well? It was fuzzy and,
you know what, I don't even care about that part. Yeah. I was just talking about the performances, the awkwardness. I was actually physically uncomfortable the first time I watched it, watching those scenes of Avery Brooks with
That's
Jennifer.
That's because you just hate beaches.
I guess so.
Yeah,
I guess so.
I've never seen you at the beach.
That's also true.
Yeah, I think that's part of your aversion to that scene.
Well, maybe. Possibly.
Okay, guys, we need to make the beach happen sooner rather than later.
Sure.
You guys definitely have to get some of those suits. You could peddle them at the beaches of Vancouver and sell out pretty quick.
For next year's Las Vegas convention, Cam and I are going on stage in the Ben Sisko beachwear.
Dude, it's like we run a Star Trek podcast. We're very pale.
Yeah.
You won't be able to hear yourselves. All the women will just be screaming.
Women? So does anyone have any final thoughts before we wrap up about Emissary? Mike, how about you start?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, I was impressed with the world they laid out in 90 minutes.
Okay, but let me ask you this. As a non-fan, would this be enough to entice you to continue on with the series? Because you're not a Star Trek fan. You're kind of a casual guy who's encountered it, you know, sporadically over your last 30 plus years.
We talked about how the ship is relied upon as kind of a plot device, a propellant of the plot. I don't think I could sit through these made up, problems that they have to fix.
But with Deep Space Nine, do you think much less so versus other series? It's like with DS9, it's not really focused on these like technical issues that they encounter. It's really based mostly on like character internal conflict.
You don't have to watch them actually drive Deep Space Nine every episode.
Okay.
They don't even do that much. This was kind of like the Sasa Sepa from Encounter at Farpoint.
Not much bridge work. Okay.
No.
I don't think it would drag me in to watch. I think we're so used to binge watching now. The pacing is a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
And the CGI is tough to take as well.
It would be tough for me to say to you, Mike, like, no, you need to watch this from beginning to end, because I think it's a big commitment, and I don't think the series really comes into its own until... Cam, you would say season 3, I would say season 4.
I would say maybe the end of season 2.
End of season 2, okay.
Yeah.
So
that's a lot of hours.
Yeah.
Before it starts to really get great. But the thing is, when it gets good, when you've invested all of that time into it, Cam, it's damn fine.
It's phenomenal.
It? Like it is amazing, and it's not like any other Star Trek that's come before or since.
Right.
And I really think that Star Trek Discovery, this is going to be what people are going to be basing like the success of Star Trek Discovery on, at least from like a kind of a writing perspective.
This pilot, yes, I agree.
Yes.
What I really like too about this pilot really reminded me of what I really like about Deep Space Nine is that it's probably the most emotional Star Trek show. Star Trek can often be a little bit stuffy. A little bit more brainy than, say, emotional. This, I think, pilot kind of hints towards that, where you have, like, Sisko breaking down over his wife, things like that. You don't get a lot of that in other Star Trek shows. Mm-hmm. And going forward, there's a lot of, like, warmth and, like, sort of humor between friends, but also, like, kind of conflict, anger. Like, it kind of pulls all the tools out of the toolbox emotionally. And I think that's what, you know, this pilot hints towards and why the series is so damn good. So while I wouldn't say that, you know, Emissary is the be-all, end-all of Deep Space Nine, I wouldn't say that at all. I would say that I think it's probably the best pilot so far, in Star Trek.
I would agree with that assessment as well. And I do wonder, because it's been a while since I watched Caretaker and Broken Bow.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting going back and rewatching those and see how they set up their universes. Because we also have the benefit of knowing how Deep Space Nine turns out.
Right.
And it'll be... Look, we're going to have this discussion eventually, but like how I think kind of Voyager did not really live up to entire premise, essentially. And it'll be interesting to watch Caretaker and see how we can judge the series based on that.
Sure.
So.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Yeah, well, speaking of Discovery, next week we're going to be talking about what characters from previous iterations of Star Trek we want to see on Star Trek Discovery. Because, of course, we know Star Trek Discovery is going to take place about 10 years before the original series, which we could get younger versions of some of those familiar recurring faces on the original series. We could also get some very old versions of people that appeared on Star Trek Enterprise.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting.
How long do Ferengis live?
I don't think it's ever been established, but we do know that Klingons live longer than humans, Vulcans live longer, and Andorians live longer than humans.
Which one are the Andorians?
They're the blue ones with the antennae that can move around.
There were none of them in this episode.
Yeah.
Star Trek Next Generation?
No, it was Star Trek The Original Series and Star Trek Enterprise featured the Andorians, and some of the Star Trek films with Shatner.
One shows up in TNG on the holodeck.
Oh, that's
right. It looks kind of goofy.
Isn't it green, though, as
opposed
to...
Yeah, it looks really crappy.
Yeah, maybe it's...
They tried to redesign it, but it did not go well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want any more Cardassians in Discovery.
Okay.
You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in visitor, comma, na-na, for the win, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N-N, as in non-linear.
And now, Mike, where are you?
I am Mike... P as in Photon Hager. Get at me with all your trolling comments about the Cardassians.
Hear that, Tyler? Oh. Get on that.
I'm going to break his internet.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.